You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Now, there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of Interstate Battery retail stores all over the United States. So whether you need a new truck battery, which, by the way, I've heard that they are some of the best in the automotive industry, right? A truck battery, a car battery. If you need batteries for something as simple as a remote control or a unique battery for a range finder or one of your children's toys, Interstate Batteries not only has those batteries available, if they don't have them, they can order them for you. Or if you need to find out more about a specific battery or the specs of a specific battery, stop into their retail store and talk with a battery specialist. These guys are very knowledgeable about what products they offer and what it is that you need for whatever battery you're looking for. So stop in to a local retail store or visit interstatebatteries.com to learn more about their company, the batteries that they offer, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So check out interstatebatteries.com. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith.
And Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you.
Welcome back to another Land and Legacy Podcast, guys. I'm so happy you guys are sharing your time with us this week. I bring on Frank Longcarriage, one of the consultants here with Land and Legacy, and we are chatting about regional differences in land management. Wow, what a big topic. What a wide-ranging topic. There's so many different examples that we share and touch on, from rainfall to vegetations to fire intervals, from quail to turkey, from Mississippi and Florida, all the way up to Iowa, Wisconsin. It is a big podcast that has a lot of information in it, but really goes into the principles of management and the realization of research from one region about a given species maybe isn't applicable in that same exact manner in another region. So we're all managing the same animal, but the differences in climate, the differences in rainfall, differences of exposure on a hillside, soil types, makes you have to adapt quite differently. So this podcast is going to be pretty eye-open, I think, and make people kind of force themselves into an open-mind management style that will ultimately increase their just success of whatever they're trying to get out of the land. So we appreciate you guys listening this week to that, but be sure that you have checked out the online store, shoplandandlegacy.tv, because there are new hats. There are all the Stratton seed blends for this fall up available online there for you to check out. But first, we need to stop and thank our partner, First Light, for being a part of this podcast and being a part of the supporting groups with Land and Legacy here. So I am currently wearing men's Kurgat pant. I've certainly fallen in love with these things. A great work pant, great consulting pants. We're out traveling around, very, very lightweight and breathable, yet pretty dang waterproof. I shouldn't say waterproof, very water resistant, and man, they're just solid, solid pants. So there's a ton of great gear. It is certainly getting into that window, that time frame in which fall is coming fast. We're late July, if not into early August right now. And so we're months away or weeks away from a lot of adventures this fall happening. So if you guys need gear, go to firstlight.com and check it out. You'll love it. You love what you use, love what you see. Be sure to read the descriptions, because there's very specialty pieces out there that they do offer for specific types of hunts or specific weather. So make sure you get the right pieces. Reward yourself. Go out there. Firstlight.com. All right. Well, I do have the man, the myth, the legend, Frank. Yeah. Longcarriage is on the podcast with us this week, and I'm excited. I'm always excited for our conversations, Frank, because I feel like, you know, either you've got something brewing in your brain or I've got something in mine. We chat about it for 5 minutes, jump on the phone call, and then wham, there's a podcast that just kind of forms. So that's essentially what we're going to do this week, is just you've got something that's been brewing, and we're going to turn it over to you and just kind of let it happen. But how have things been out your way?
They've been good. They've been good. Thanks. Thanks for having me. I appreciate being on always. Things are going good. And of course, my mind's always thinking about quail.
Yeah.
Always an upland game birds. And so, you know, in thinking about it, this is a critical time. This is where we are making our hunting population right now. This is the time when the hens are nesting, pulling off broods. Brood survival is super critical. And a lot of that is dependent on precipitation, as we've talked about in past podcasts, and the importance of, depending on where you're at in the quail world, and we'll talk about that more, but in where we're at, you know, sort of in the range east of Kansas, rain can be a detriment if it comes at the wrong time of year. And luckily our June and early July was pretty dry here in this part of the world, which means that brood survival was probably going to be fairly good. We've had some of those, you know, blow up, pop up showers that, you know, dump a quarter to a half inch on a certain place. And so as with anything, anytime you get spotty rains like that, you know, you're going to have variable brood survival across your landscape. But overall, and based on the number of reports that I'm getting of people seeing broods, I'm excited about that. And speaking of that, quick shout out to one of our landowners a landowner in Western Kansas on which you and I did a consultant trip last January. He's reporting seeing lots of quail broods in the places where he did the brood patches and did the recommended management. And so that's always exciting to hear.
Yeah. And I think we did
seeing results.
We did a podcast, I believe, on that trip too, or on our way back. So if you guys want to go and listen to kind of what those recommendations were in great detail, what we were seeing as we were on site, and then what was recommended, and then now put into place, not probably completely, but just from a quick, you know, spring into summer, he's experiencing great success. And that's the cool thing about it, Frank. And that's why I love managing open landscapes and doing simple techniques right out of the get-go, is because you can experience and see changes very quickly. And that's exactly what he has been experiencing. So it's definitely good to get that feedback, get those pictures, and continue to just kind of help develop and work, you know, remotely here, but just through text and conversation, that property is well on its way to being fine-tuned from a bird mecca, what it seems like.
Yeah, that was great to get those updates, and sort of that sort of leads into kind of what we wanted to talk about today, and kind of looking at it from two subjects. One is how these, you know, bobwhite quail, and again, it's probably going to be bobwhite centric, but there'll be some other game birds that we'll talk about. And a lot of this can be adapted to land management in general.
Absolutely.
Early successional management specifically. But, you know, bobwhite range from the East Coast all the way to Eastern Colorado. So they've got a huge range. They run from, you know, Southern Wisconsin down into Mexico. So they've got a huge latitudinal range too. And because of that, one can't expect that management for these critters is the same across the range. I mean, that's not right at all. So we have to one, realize that, understand that. We have to realize what the mechanisms are that are driving quail populations wherever we're at in the world.
Yep.
And then how to specifically manage for that. And so, you know, one of the things that I wanted to talk about first is, you know, the mechanics of kind of what drive quail populations. And Kyle hit on it in an earlier podcast with Adam, but quail are largely driven by rainfall in much of the range, especially out west. Mm, so we're talking western Kansas, western Oklahoma, west Texas, and those more droughty landscapes with sandy soils or even clay soils. Mm-hmm. The rainfall is really what's going to make or break their quail population. If they get average to above average rainfall, and they get a flush of early successional habitat, forbs, weeds on the landscape, and if the properties haven't been overgrazed, then quail populations do really, really well. They boom. They actually, you know, exceed, you know, what we would expect, because brood survival is so high and nest success is so high because there's so much habitat on the landscape that there's just so many places for these quail to hide, so many nesting clumps, and predation rates are low.
Mm-hmm.
Now, excess rainfall east of Kansas, you know, is at the wrong time of the year is detrimental to quail. So,
yeah,
you know, you got to look at precipitation differently depending on where you're at. I'll give you an example of where that doesn't even tell the whole story. And in Georgia and Florida, particularly where they're doing a lot of quail work, you have sites there that see relatively the same precipitation. They're in the same region, so they, you know, they average precipitation that's relatively the same from site to site. But some sites are sandy soil,
sure,
and some sites are heavy clay soil. And in the sandy soil areas, they actually do a lot of brood habitat patches because there's not as many forbs, there's not as much brood cover in those sandier soils. So they actually do a lot of brood habitat manipulation, like doing ragweed plantings or other stuff to enhance the amount of forbs on the ground.
Sure.
Whereas on the sandier sites, they can get by with prescribed burning at proper times of the year, and they really have enough forbs that they don't really have to worry about brood planting. So even in a region that's close by, soil differences can make a difference in how they manage. So it's important to really know the mechanisms that are driving populations in your area to really know how to manage. And I think that's part of the fun, I think, in this management is figuring out the puzzle, figuring out what drives your particular property, what makes it tick, and then knowing how to manage based on that.
Well, 100%. You hit on so many good points, but one of the biggest overall deals in what you've been saying is there's no blanket statement that says this is going to yield X improvement in across the Bob White's range. And same thing can be said for likely wild turkey. And same thing from a stress period standpoint can be said from a whitetail standpoint. Let's say as divided as the hunting community is or can be in some certain mm-hmm. situations, they're still so well connected. And so like social media, hunting groups, clubs, things like that. Like everybody talks about things that they're passionate about. They share observation, they share success stories and failures. So like, despite there being like, you know, different groups and categories, we're all still very well connected and do share a lot between each other. But when that happens, I think what often, let's say, is left out of that equation of sharing information is where they're located at in the country.
Uh-huh.
And that plays, obviously, taken from what you just said, a humongous, humongous difference and importance, because you cannot apply what happens on a farm in Michigan and apply it to Georgia and expect the same results.
That's right.
And yep. You can't do the same thing from a quail world of West Texas and expect the same thing happen in the Piedmont of Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
It's you're managing the same species, and I think we've talked about this on the podcast before, and it just holds, I guess, a lot of weight. Is you have to manage around principles, and based on those principles in your region, you're going to have to fluctuate your techniques to match that principle with your region. And I think that people just want to just take a success from West Texas or a success from Southern Iowa or a success from, you know, great turkey populations in Middle Tennessee and just say, well, there's dairy farms and cattle farms and big timber there, so I'm just going to – I want that here. It doesn't work like that.
That's right. That's right. That's an excellent point when you mentioned principles. And if we bring it back to the quail world, quail, the principal habitat that they need all across their range is they need early successional habitat, and they need some shrubs in one form or another scattered mm-hmm. throughout the landscape. If you've got some grass for scattered grass for nesting, lots of forbs for insect production and food, some bare ground for movability, mobility, and the shrubs, that's what quail need in principle across their range.
Sure.
Now, how to achieve that in West Texas is quite different than how to achieve that, as you mentioned, in Virginia,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And the timing of manipulation in West Texas, if they do a prescribed burn for forb production, they may not have to come back, or in woody cover control, they may not have to come back and burn that for another 5 or 6 years, probably at a minimum.
Yeah.
We can't get away with that in Southern Missouri,
right?
We have to burn things every other year, or at a minimum every 3 years, or maximum, I guess, every 3 years to achieve some level of early successional habitat and woody cover control. The principles are still the same. We're using the same techniques to achieve the desired growth on the landscape or the desired results. But the mechanisms and the timing behind how we do that are quite different.
Absolutely.
So it's important to know where you're at in the landscape. So if you're looking, you know, if you're in a lot of the great quail research is coming out of Georgia and Florida and in Texas. And a lot of that is certainly applicable to Southern Iowa. But if mm-hmm. you're doing, if you're basing your management based on what they do in West Texas or what they do in Florida on your property in Southern Iowa, that may not work. Because timing is different, your soils are different, the place in the world is different in terms of winter weather, that you've got to take that all into effect. The principles are the same, like you mentioned. That was a great point, but the dynamics behind that are quite different.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, so like, there's some people out there who have a tough time of like wrapping their head around, like, let's say, a variable situation, because they're, I guess quite frankly, there's just not an equation that will say if you do X plus X, this will equal this. It's like if you have the number of growing degree days between frosts, and you do and you add in amount of rainfall for your given area, this is when you should do. Like, no, you can't even do that, because every year that rainfall is an average. Like, you might not get that every single year. You might be experiencing an extremely wet season, so that throws off this. And I think when we term ourselves as a land manager, we have to be in tune with the land. If there was just like this magic equation of like, oh, this research said this in Texas, I'm going to apply it here and I'm going to get, you know, again, this same type of result, then we wouldn't be having a decrease in bobwhite quail populations. We wouldn't be seeing the things that we see to the extent if this all was just as like, I'm going to take this information, apply it here, and I'm going to be good. There's mm-hmm. just variances. And I think, again, as that term we use, that term land manager, that means we have to be in tune with what's going on your site, in your region, at any given time.
Yes.
I think Adam and Kyle just recently did the podcast on, you know, the hot and dry weather. Well, hot and dry, is extremely variable across whichever region you're at. You know, you could be used to hot and dry, and you're like, well, this is just a normal summer day. Or you could be up in Wisconsin, be like, well, northern Wisconsin. Cause I think southern Wisconsin gets less rain than we do here in southern Missouri. But just generally speaking, wherever you're at, it is – there's no blanket statements, let's say. It's very, very – you know, based on your region and what specifically your site needs to occur. You can, even on the same property, you can't manage, let's say, an old field stand in a bottomland as you manage an upland site for the old field management.
You
have two different sites. You can't apply the same stuff. And, like, the expression of the vegetation that comes back, even if you get the same rain, it's going to be different between the two sites. But we just have to be so in tune with the land and what it's saying, what the expression's going to be with what we're given in that year of the rain, late frost, early frost, all these things.
Yeah, you know, that's right. And that goes back to sort of that example I was given about in Georgia, where you've got two different sites separated by a few miles, but one is sandy soil and one is heavy clay soil. You know, even how they manage that with even within the same region is different. And I think that's one of the cool things about our jobs is that's one of the things that I enjoy when I'm doing a task for my job, whether it's cookie cutter or it's the same thing over and over. That's the most, you know, tedious stuff that I do, and I don't enjoy it.
Right.
But where we're working with the variable, like we're going to burn a piece of ground, I'm excited to see how that's going to respond the next year. And maybe it responded great, or maybe it didn't respond well. Well, we got to figure out why didn't it respond well. Was it something with rainfall after it? Was it the type of fire we did? Mm-hmm. Was it, you know, there's so many variables, and figuring that out is one of the cool things about what we do. And one of the things that I really enjoy is figuring out the dynamics behind what we are seeing, because they do vary. And that's the cool thing about land management is I guarantee you that you cannot predict the response that you're going to get. You know, you can go out and say, I'm going to burn this woodland unit on March 30th. And this is what I'm going to see. Well, maybe, or maybe not. You know, it depends on what has been done to that unit in the past. It depends on the seed bank. It depends on a whole lot of things. So that's one of the coolest things about it is, and it's also a frustrating part about it, right? Because you're expecting something and you may not get it. Like, dang, this didn't work, you know, and it's frustrating, but it's a learning experience. Every time we apply a prescription to a piece of property, it's a learning experience. We're going to learn something from that.
And you know, from one year to the next, you're going to have those variances and the way the seed bank is going to respond. And that could be thought of as negative, but I think it's a positive because, again, there's some diversity across the property that you maybe weren't expecting. Maybe it turns out better than what you wanted, or maybe it addresses a need of a limited resource better than what you thought. You just don't know exactly what that expression is. It's a little bit of a roll of the dice, but again, going back to the principle of it, we know prescribed fire is good, and we know, generally speaking, when we do dormant versus growing season fires, what's going to happen, and there's, again, a variance, a spectrum in which that response is most likely going to act or respond to, or within, I guess is the right terms. It's going to respond within this kind of parameter. It's going to favor forbs, or it's going to favor grasses, or it's going to help control or top kill more of your saplings, whatever the case may be. We know it's probably going to fit within this, but again, there's a little bit of variances, and that's fun. That's fun to see, but it's just not cookie cutter.
Yeah, right.
It's not math. Like when you have a math equation, you have two things, and there's variables in math, right? But like you, it spits out a number, an exact answer.
Yep.
That's not land management. And if you're looking for that in land management, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah,
so let's just scratch that, remove that off the table. It's not like if I plant soybeans in my food plot at 80 pounds an acre, do it the right times, apply the right herbicide, remove my weeds, do it, this and that, I will have bean pods to hunt over. Nope.
Yeah,
nope.
Right.
Can't guarantee it. Cannot guarantee it.
Right.
But
right.
Again, like to me, it's a part of that. And I know that you're there too, and you're understanding, Adam, Kyle. This is what we really try and preach. It's like, it's almost refreshing, because as many things that we do or have done, let's say as a human beings on the planet, it's a good thing that we just don't have the say of like, oh, I'm going to do this and this is going to be the response. Like nature and creation works in its system, and we just need to learn the system and then embrace it. And all those mm-hmm. principles that we know will follow suit. It's going to happen. We just need to figure those things out in your given region.
Yeah, you're right. You know, and to kind of to segue to the next topic based on that, you know, the last thing you said was in your given region. That is a huge part of what I want to talk about in terms of the quail decline.
Mm-hmm.
We know that bobwhite quail declined over 80% across their range, you know, from east to west. The western part of the range hasn't declined as much, but it certainly has declined. But one of the things you cannot say with any sort of certainty is that the mechanism behind or the dynamics behind that decline are the same across the country.
Yeah.
Absolutely can't say that.
Correct.
And that is what you must understand. The reason why your local population declined, if you expect to turn that around and try to make your local population increase,
mm-hmm.
you've got to figure out why it declined in the first place before you can turn that situation around. And that's what I want to talk about here, is that the changes across the country and the reasons why quail decline are different. So let's take where we're at in the southwest part of Missouri. So basically the fescue belt, which is probably from the Flint Hills, the eastern side of the Flint Hills in Kansas, through about western Kentucky and Tennessee, maybe all the way to the eastern Kentucky and Tennessee, sort of this fescue belt. You know, our forage for cattle and as a result, the early successional habitats or our open lands are dominated by tall fescue, in some cases Bermuda grass, but dominated by tall fescue. And that has just eliminated the early successional habitat for bobwhite quail. That is the number one factor driving our quail population down here in this part of Missouri and probably most of Missouri,
mm-hmm.
Arkansas, eastern Kansas, eastern Oklahoma, you know, and sort of that fescue belt that we talk about, is the predominance of fescue. That has eliminated forbs, that's eliminated bare ground, it's eliminated the early successional usable space, the shrubs, there's no shrubs in these fescue fields. This is the land use of going primarily to a fescue based forage system is what caused our quail decline.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not what has caused the quail decline in Iowa and Nebraska and Illinois.
Right.
That is large scale conversion to crop, such that there's very, very little early successional habitat, grasses and forbs, because most of that, which was tall grass prairie in the past, has been converted to crops.
Yeah.
And there's very little space for early successional habitat because it's largely farmed fence to fence in these extensive ag operations. But if you look at the Southeast, a lot of what's driving their quail decline is the removal of fire. They're in more of a woodland system where historically fires kept open savannas and woodlands. So these mm-hmm. long-leaf savannas or even short-leaf pine savannas that had a really lush, herbaceous understory. Well, lack of fire and converting to sort of pine plantations where fire is not a part of the system is what's largely causing that quail decline. So three different regions, still seeing quail declines, but three different mechanisms and dynamics that are resulting in that decline. So it's important to realize that there's different dynamics operating on this one tiny bird to cause it to decline. And you've got to figure out where you sit in the landscape to figure out how you can change it.
And there's a lot of overlap of those, like even within those regions, of fire, of herbicide, of crops, of pasture land. You know, those are general reasons why across those let's say given regions that you described. But mm-hmm. I think Mike Chamberlain, and I'm applying a phrase that he said to regarding wild turkeys, but again can be applied to probably Bob White's and just their fragile state. It's a death by a thousand cuts. And as a total population, there's many, many different reasons as to why they do it. But in what you're saying is, hey, in these regions, this is the driving factor. This mm-hmm. is the majority, the lion's share of the decline in these given regions of what's happened, what's been occurring, and as a result of that, quail numbers are going down mm-hmm. quickly, unfortunately. But you know what?
That's right.
It's refreshing to me from a standpoint of, you know, when we look at the tools that are part of the decline, if you will. I'm going to say this kind of broadly, but when you look at some of the tools that land managers have access to and use to manage the landscape with. So cattle, so that's bringing like the fescue side of things. Mm-hmm. Herbicides, which is bringing in, you know, back into the pasture. A lot of people are, you know, spraying pastures routinely just to get a grass, just get grass. Forbs bad. Mm-hmm. Anything broadleaf they don't want in their pastures, minus some clover. But there's so much clover out there that pops and comes just about every single year, even when you're spraying broadleafs.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got the disc, you know, from crop fields. And then you've got the lack of fire in many of these places, and the axe, so timbering, logging, all those different things. Those are five different tools that in all those regions you talked about have played a role in the decline. But, you know, the craziest thing about it is, what would we use to bring quail back? Those same five different tools in
That's
each
right.
of those regions. It's not that, if you will, it's a mismanagement of given tools that have declined habitat quality mm-hmm. and or removed just habitat in general. Either someplace you go to and you're like, there just ain't nothing here. Like, there's no habitat. But
yeah.
But the cool thing is, the same things, if we just use those tools wisely and appropriately, we can help increase quail.
That's right.
It's like this weird dynamic that I don't think people grasp. It's almost like, oh, you've got to be on one side or the other, either, you know, pro herbicide or you hate it, or pro logging or you hate it. Good mm-hmm. prescribed buyers, good or bad. Cows are good or bad. No, it's not. They're all good in their own realm and put to use wisely. They're all great tools.
That's exactly right. That's absolutely right. We can use those same tools. I think Leopold had a quote about uh-huh. that. That's uh-huh. something about these tools that have caused the wildlife decline are the same tools that can turn it around and cause them to come back. And you know it, that prescribed fires is a great example of that. You know, we need logging is a great example for that. You know, logging is not bad, and tree removal is provides excellent wildlife habitat,
mm-hmm.
but it could also cause a complete destruction of wildlife habitat, where you have these huge clear cuts that are a temporary, you know, loss of wildlife habitat. Now it quickly recovers and whatnot, mm-hmm. but you know, you're right about this, about these mechanisms. You know, they're on a spectrum. We need to realize that is all of this land management stuff falls on a spectrum, and how we use it
yes.
Depends on where we use it in that spectrum. Grazing is a great example. We have most of our tall fescue is too heavily grazed. It is too beat down. There's very, very little habitat for grassland birds. But we also have a lot of our prairie landscapes or our expiring CRPs, CP areas that are too thick for grassland habit, for grassland songbirds, bobwhite, quail, pheasants, things like that. But we can utilize grazing to get that landscape back into the condition we want. So the tool that is being used in a way that's causing wildlife habitat to decline on fescue can be used in a way to create abundant quail numbers in tall grass prairies or in expiring CRPs. The tool itself is not bad. Cattle are not bad.
Correct.
Cattle, the application of it or how it's used is what is going to be driving the way our land is managed. And so that's something we need to keep that in mind, you know, that these blanket, you know, grazing is bad. Well, no, it's not. Inherently it's not. It's how it's applied can be viewed as good or bad based on how you view it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that's where it's important to understand where you are in the landscape and to understand what's caused the decline. And you mentioned that there could be compounding factors, or there could be multiple factors. And I'll give you a really great example of that is where I grew up hunting in Southwest Missouri, largely our decline in quail is based on the abundance of fescue and the fescue grazing culture and the abundance of it around here. But when I go back and look at the lands that I grew up hunting, most of those have lost their quail because the landowners had allowed it to grow up into early successional woodland and then eventually to closed canopy woodland and forest over the years.
Yeah.
When I was hunting it, it was still broom sedge grass, ragweed, scattered clumps of plum. There were some oak sprouts coming in. You know, you could tell that, you know, it was kind of on the verge from, you know, going into a woodland, but there were still quail around. And then when I revisited these areas 20 years later, you know, they were woodcock and then, you know, woodcock habitat and then closed canopy forest. So in a fescue landscape, yes, the quail populations are being driven by fescue, but those local populations declined because of a lack of management on those early successional habitats, and they succeeded into forest.
Right.
So you're right, is there could be multiple things working on a local population that is causing problems.
It's just dynamic. There's not a clear cut reason answer for everything. And I think, again, that's just like the almost human nature of, we just try and apply simplicity to some complex answers, you know, the predators and prey. That is so complex.
Oh,
you can't even begin to say, oh, this is good, that's bad. No, honestly, it's just an ignorant statement. And saying that, again, like the cattle example, cattle are bad for wildlife. No, that's an ignorant statement. It is highly variable dependent upon the forages, how they're grazing, how they're being grazed, what they're grazing itself, and the density. I mean, we could go on and on and on about the dynamics of grazing as a tool, but cows are not bad for wildlife.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's, you know, you've got to have an open mind about all this and not be closed off. And I will admit, when I first, you know, started, you know, doing wildlife management work and coming in and from college and, you know, as an early professional, you have biases and you have things that you believe are absolutes, and that is absolutely wrong. You're going to naturally go into these things with your inherent biases. But as what I've learned, and I see it with younger professionals that are getting into it, you know, they have their biases. They have things that they believe are absolutes, but you quickly learn that there aren't absolutes in this world that we're in. There aren't things that are absolute. And but people still do hold their biases. I've dealt with people that absolutely believe that cattle are bad for wildlife and bad for the landscape because of the thing that they are most interested in would be something that maybe cattle would harm in the short term. And no matter of convincing them will, or no matter of talking to them or debating them, will get them to change their mind. And those people are ones that are unreasonable. And you know, you're probably not going to change your mind anyway. And that's not a good, way to go about this. It's important to have an open mind. There are some things that we have found out in our quail study that Kyle and I found out that have completely changed how we manage quail based on what we found on this quail study. If we hadn't have done this, we would think absolutely that the peak of quail hatch is June 15th. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not. And so that is an absolute that we have, you know, that we have had to let go of, and advice that we had to let go of based on what the data is showing us. And I think that is important. You've got to approach this with an open mind, be willing to learn, be willing to adapt, and you're going to be a lot more successful if you do that.
Well, I think that's a really important thing, and I was going to share that as well. And I don't know if that's a bold statement or whatever, but I would say that the degree of how open your mind is, there's a strong correlation to the success that you'll have as a land manager when managing for improved either wildlife, populations, what have you.
Yep.
If you have a closed mind, you're limiting your success and growth and the land's growth, which I think we all owe it. There is a land ethic out there that we should all be striving to improve and work to, I guess, just simply improve the land itself. But if you have a closed mind when it comes to land management practices and the tools that we have access to, you are the limiting factor. It's not the land itself. It's your willingness to be creative, try different things, have an open mind to new research, change your ways. That's the limiting factor. It's not the land. Restoration, we've seen it. I know you have, Frank, just incredible restoration examples across the country of land. You're like, wow, I did not think we'd get that expression back. I didn't know if that land was too far gone or what.
Mm-hmm.
It happens. It'll come back. Yeah. We can do it, but we just have got to be flexible and open-minded with it all.
Yep. You know, and a good example of that was sort of what we talked about when we opened the podcast, when we gave the example of the landowner that was seeing good numbers of quail this year in his brood patches. When I think when we approached him with the idea of, hey, you've got some native warm season grass here that you planted, let's go in and kill it all, spray it, disc it up. I think he may have wanted to throw us off his property there at first because, like, what do you mean? I'm killing pheasants out of here. I'm killing big deer. But to his great credit, he was open-minded to understand the science and see, you know, these juvenile quail, these juvenile pheasants need lots of early successional forbs. They need lots of bare ground. This tall grass isn't doing them any good at that stage. I need to add more of that. And my quail and my deer are going to benefit because there's going to be so much more forage for them to access that, hey, I'm going to give it a try. And so he was open-minded and he did it. And I think he's pretty excited about what he's seeing. And that was a great example of being taking some of these dogmas that you truly believe and you know, throwing them out as dogmas is what they are, and then trying something new. And there's a lot of that, and there could be a whole nother podcast example of all this dogma and wildlife science and wildlife management that, you know, people have believed and practiced and that hold on to very, very strongly that probably have no place in wildlife management or wildlife science anymore.
I think
a lot of people are invested in it because maybe they had a hand in developing that dogma, or they just, you know, ego gets in the way, whatever it is, or they had success one time, you know?
Yep.
But if we're really going to change the game for the species that we're most interested in, we're going to have to give up some of these previously held beliefs that just aren't working anymore, and adapt.
Yes, I totally agree on that. And to unpack that a little bit more, of that landowner that we had visited with, I think you have to take into context that perspective that he has grown up in that region. Yep. It is a very heavy dominated crop area, also very heavy CRP, and the type of cover that exists outside of CRP, small little woodlots or creek drainages, and we're talking very small percentage of the landscape out there in this region. I would say easy less than 10% would be a woody type cover. So what the gentleman was experiencing when it comes to success from years past in harvesting both pheasants and quail was primarily in CRP. So very heavy grass area. So here's a gentleman who had come to see his success was dependent upon very grass heavy areas. 90% grass essentially in many of these places, many of these farms or acres. And now we come in and say, hey, one of the issues is the grass. There's too much of it. I mean, put yourself in his shoes. You know, yeah. Again, here's an area where cover's relatively limited. His only success in hunting is focused in and around these areas of cover. Now these two guys from Southwest Missouri come and say, hey, one of the issues is the cover. It's the wrong cover or the wrong composition of cover. That would set a lot of people back on their heels and say, yes. whoa, hey guys, you know, this is, if you will, I make a living on killing the birds in these areas. And you're telling me that it's not good? Well, this is the best that there is in the neighborhood. And I think that's another, if you will, dogma of people saying, hey, I know that farm over there, it's good, but you're telling me that it can be improved or it should be improved? Well, research and science tells us that even though he's being really successful in killing birds on that, 160 acres of CRP, that doesn't mean it can't be better. And we're in the process on that property specifically, making it better. And that text update was a very good indicator that removing some of the grass in multiple different ways, whether it was dormant season disking, I think this year he's going to be trying and utilizing some herbicide applications to remove the grass specifically, and burning at different rotations, he will see that increase. And I'm 100% confident in that. But again, we went to a region where, if you will, he was one of the top players when it comes to rearing birds and killing them, bringing guests in, having great success. But that great success is only going to go up, exponentially with these other practices. So if you're in an area and you're saying, man, I kill the biggest, the best deer, or I've got the most turkeys, this and that, well, again, that is fantastic. But that doesn't mean that it can't be better or that it shouldn't be improved or shouldn't be addressed. There's still most likely weaknesses in that habitat that need to be addressed and be improved. And I think that sometimes we get caught up in like the, oh, well, in my region, this is the best of the top caliber. I mean, how do we know that? You can't go around and measure. There's no gauge to measure the potential necessarily of a given track or a given individual within a population. You can't do that. And so I think just in that realm of, hey, even though you may believe you bought into a good neighborhood or a good region, man, if you're settling for what that region tells you is good, you're probably selling that area short, because the habitat in most places just isn't the right composition. We talked about the grasses and forbs, isn't the right composition for every species that you're trying to promote on a property. So that in and itself is a dogma of, I know I'm doing good stuff, but man, it probably we're here to say it probably can be better.
Yes, it can be. It can be. And the cool thing about it is research in wildlife science is critically important, and I support it. We need to do more of it, but by and large, we have the broad, we broadly know the tools that will work, has mm-hmm. repeated to work, has been proven to work across the country based on where you're at. Now, you may have to try something different in Oklahoma versus what you're going to do in southern Iowa in terms of, you know, how much woody cover you provide. Perhaps you need more in southern Iowa than you do in west Oklahoma.
Yeah.
And so those regional differences are important, but broadly we know what's going to work to bring back quail, pheasant, deer, to improve our deer forage, our deer, mm-hmm. excuse me, our deer sex composition, age composition, whatever it may be. So we've, you know, that's, we are in a great time in history in that we are not back in the 40s and 50s still trying to, you know, sort this stuff out, still mm-hmm. trying to figure this stuff out. We're in a good place in history. And again, I say that with a caveat, if we continue to need to do research, particularly on things that we don't quite understand, you know, the turkey decline, we don't quite understand that to the level that we need to.
Yeah.
We need to continue to approach that with good research. But the point is we are a great, we're in a great place that we sort of know where to go and know what is going to work. And the sort of to bring that back to the overarching topic of this podcast is, even though we know what's going to work, we know the principles behind what's going to restore populations in our specific land or in our specific region, those may need to be applied differently, or certainly will need to be applied differently depending on where we're at in the country. So this cookie cutter approach will not work. So prescribed fire will work from Texas, West Texas, all the way to Georgia, but the timing, application, you know, the return interval, all that's different, all that's dynamic, depending on where you're at. And it's important to know where you're at in the landscape, where you're at in the world, how you're going to do that. And one of those things we talked about is shrubby cover. Quail are often called a shrub obligate species because they have to have shrubby cover. Well, the amount of shrubby cover that they need in Southwest Missouri is different than what they need in North Missouri. So mm-hmm. even within the same state, it differs. We can get away. So there's been research that shows that bobwhites can do well anywhere from 5 to 25% woody cover on the landscape. But they're going to do better in, say, southern Iowa if you're on that higher end of that spectrum, because you have so much, you have the potential to have so much more colder weather and so much more heavy snow than we do in South Missouri, that your shrubby cover component and composition and distribution across the landscape can be somewhat less here in our part of the state versus northern Missouri. So
those
are important things to remember, and that when you're looking at research and you're looking at social media posts across the country, you need to take that with a grain of salt and think, okay, how, yes, that works, but how is that going to work where I'm at? Do I need to plant as many plum thickets on my land as they're doing in Nebraska? Do I need to burn as often on my land as they are in Southwest Missouri? Maybe you do, maybe you don't. And that's where contacting folks like us to give a better idea of, you know, folks that have done it, have had the experience that have done it year after year and actually put it in on the ground over multiple seasons can sort of really cut that learning curve way down.
I think that's exactly what it comes down to, is just navigating and troubleshooting, foreseeing the future and removing the learning curve for someone to be able to execute these types of disturbances, and at the right rate, the right interval, having the right composition of plant communities out there on the landscape for the species that they want. So like you were just, you know, specifically talking quail there, and I know someone's probably out there like, well, you know, that's quail, guys, they're very fragile. But I'm literally this morning been working on a property whose main focus is white-tailed deer out of central Mississippi. The property's got both quite a bit of hardwoods,
varying ages of pine plantations. And just in pine plantations, we're talking extreme variances in the basal area that these places are going to be cut to. And then we're going to be managing the hardwood areas and vastly different basal areas as well, and doing medium TSI. Some areas could be clear cut, some are going to be very open. But what that response is going to then give us is a completely different understory in all those regions or all those areas across the farm. And then at that point, we're still going to be managing, even if it's a 20 basal area on some of these pines, well, we might have some areas that we're burning every other year, and then some that we're burning every 4 years. So even within those same stands, within the same amount of light that those places are getting, we're going to dictate that vegetation response underneath of those overstory pines by the fire. So we're creating the different habitat. So like, even in, like, it's just not like, okay, hardwoods, you do this. Well, we're going to be cutting them differently, and then we're going to be burning them differently too. And then in the pines, we're going to be doing the exact same thing. There are different stages, but the end result is I want this to be at that basal area and then burned on that rotation, and then this one over here at this basal area and then burned on this rotation. So now we've got the diversity across the whole property. But you look at the amount of growing season that central Mississippi has versus southern Iowa, you're probably talking 45, 60 days at least longer in a growing season. So the burn rate or the interval is going to be, of course, much less. We're talking month and a half, 2 months easy of difference in growing seasons.
Right.
So you think about like the first couple weeks of first month and a half of a growing season in your general area. How much green up occurs there? Now extrapolate that out across the whole growing season. Yeah, we're going to have big changes and big differences from that landscape in southern Iowa versus landscape in central Mississippi, and how we need to manage it for the species, the composition, the plant communities, and the distribution of that across an entire site.
Yeah.
Changes. And
that's right. And that can be daunting, and that can be overwhelming. And as a landowner that may be, you know, an electrician or an engineer or whatever that has just got a piece of ground, that is some daunting stuff. And where do I start? You know, and they wouldn't know the dynamics behind when to burn different stands, or what my soil types are across my farm. We did that one consult in southeastern Oklahoma that had different soil types and different slope exposures across the landscape. And so the management was going to be different, even on that same property.
Yes.
Even within maybe the same chunk of that property, you have glade type with transition into woodland, which may be transition into savanna. You know, that is some stuff that can be daunting, and maybe your average landowner that hasn't spent a lifetime studying wildlife science understands that. And that's where I think the services that we provide are so valuable, in that we have spent our lives trying to figure this stuff out, and can write a prescription and can guide you through it step by step. It's not just a once, here's your plan, you know, see you later. No, it's nothing like, I mean, it's constant updates. It's, you know, it's how you guys doing. And, you know, it's texting back and forth, sending pictures. It's really a guide such that I wouldn't know the first thing about, you know, building my house, you know, and I wouldn't expect a general contractor to know as much about wildlife science as maybe you and me. So that's, I think, where we can come in and really cause that learning curve to be much less daunting and much less overwhelming, and really line it out so that we can set these dynamics up to where it's, this is understandable. The light bulb comes on. I understand this now, you know, because we're laying it out. I think that's the importance of these sort of these services that we provide.
Definitely. I think without a doubt. And just to recap, is there's no cookie cutter there. You just can't use,
the same techniques everywhere you go in the same way and to manage different varying species. And the, you know, the other thing cool, Frank, that I really like and enjoy as many different places as just you and I have been or Land and Legacy in general, every landowner in that region though too has slightly different goals.
Yes.
And that's the cool part is kind of getting to the root of, you know, what is it that you want this property to accomplish and be like, and what kind of experiences and memories do you want to have here? Because that's then going to dictate also what it is we do, how we do it. And but it's fun to go like, all right, well, here's your roadmap. Here's how you go create, go make those memories, have fun, experience, and keep us updated along the way.
Yep, absolutely. I enjoy that. It's the variety and that makes our jobs so fun, is to determine what the goals that they want. And then we can sit down and use our heads like, okay, this is what he wants. Mm-hmm. How can we make this happen? And that takes brain power. That takes experience. That takes, you know, a level of, you know, understanding what the landscape looks like. And that's fun, is trying to put that whole puzzle together. And that whole plan is really challenging, and it's very enjoyable to me. I enjoy that part of it.
Absolutely. Well, Frank, I really appreciate your time coming on. And
absolutely.
You know, this podcast, I think, was definitely a good timely one for everyone going into fall and going into, let's say, a little bit more of a hunting season time frame.
Yeah.
But it's never too early, let's say, to begin thinking about what those next year plans are. You know, what does the next growing season kind of have in store for me? How am I going to be applying all these different techniques across my property? Do I need further assistance or am I tackling this on my own? So it keeps those wheels turning in the minds of all those who are listening. And we appreciate everyone who does listen every single week. It's such a joy to be able to get those responses back. And but Frank, I certainly appreciate your time coming on.
You bet. Thanks, Matt. And I always enjoy talking with you. This kind of went off on a couple of tangents, but that's what I think makes this so fun.
I think so.
We, you know, we can get off on a tangent and discuss things that maybe we hadn't talked about, but that's cool.
Yeah.
Enjoy that.
Absolutely, sir. Sounds good. I always enjoy those conversations with Frank. He is, he's got such a creative mind and so much knowledge revolving around land management, specifically extensive knowledge on quail. But him and Frank and Kyle both, are just extremely knowledgeable about just wild game populations, restoring native vegetation and plant communities, and the spatial aspect of those features across a landscape. They got it. They know it. And so just starting a conversation, hit the record button on a podcast gear and just kind of seeing where it takes us. I just enjoy that. And I hope you guys do too. We appreciate you guys listening. Be sure to head over to social media pages, Facebook and Instagram, as well as YouTube. There are some consistent video dropping throughout the summer and spring. Certainly as we go into the fall as well, about different habitat techniques, hunts that we've had. And so if you guys want kind of a firsthand look and observation of all the different techniques we've been using, we recommend, and some of the products of those techniques, be sure to go to YouTube, check it out, subscribe to the page, and we would certainly appreciate you guys' support there. And be sure, as you're out there searching the web, that you go to GoStrattonSeed.com. That is GoStrattonSeed.com. Check out all their blends. Check out a great company. Been around since 1940s. They are heavy hitters when it comes to the commodity crop side and are now putting a huge footprint into the food plot side of things. Awesome wildlife blends. And they have just been open-minded and working with us and trying different species and testing. Man, it's just been a joy to work with them. So if you guys are interested in their blends and learning about the company, definitely go check out GoStrattonSeed.com. And if you don't have a dealer
near you. And there's a dealer page on their webpage, so you can check out if there is someone local. But if not, then go to Shopland Legacy and order some online, work up some shipping, and send it out your way. But, guys, we appreciate it. Appreciate you listening. And whatever you're going out to do this fall, maybe this weekend, in preparation for fall, have fun. Enjoy it. And share some of the success stories with us. We'd love to be able to hear from you guys, whether it's through info@landandlegacy.tv or if it comes through social media channels, through messaging. Guys, we appreciate it. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week. Yeah.